From Washington, the Voice of America brings you Press Conference USA, an unrehearsed discussion program. Each week at this time, reporters interview an interesting personality in the news. Today's program originates at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. VOA correspondent Rhett Turner will introduce our guest of the week and the news panel. Our guest on Press Conference USA is one of the best-known figures in the United States manned space exploration program, Mr. Christopher Kraft, Director of Flight Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center here in Houston. Mr. Kraft and his associates are the men responsible for the conduct of space missions whenever American astronauts leave the Earth. Chris Kraft, as most people know him, has been part of the National Aeronautics and Space Program since 1945, when he joined the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. He was part of the original Space Task Group formed in 1958. He has become well known to most Americans for his supervision of the conduct of all U.S. manned flights from liftoff to recovery. A native of Virginia, Mr. Kraft was educated as an aeronautical engineer at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute. He has received two honorary doctorate degrees from the Indiana Institute of Technology and from St. Louis University. In 1963, he received the National Space Agency Distinguished Service Award from President Kennedy and was selected as one of the 100 Outstanding Young Americans by Life magazine in 1962. Chris Kraft has been with us on many of our broadcasts of manned space flights, and I'm sure his voice is familiar to most of you. Mr. Kraft, welcome to Press Conference USA.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And now let's ask our correspondents to identify themselves.
I'm Arthur Hill of the Houston Chronicle.
This is Edward K. DeLong of United Press International.
And Jim Maloney with the Houston Post.
And for our first question to Mr. Kraft, let's turn to you, Mr. Hill.
Chris, I wonder if you could give us your own summation of how the Apollo program has gone to date and possibly compare its progress with that of the Gemini program, which we just concluded.
Well, certainly the Apollo program started rather slowly. You must recognize that we've actually been designing the spacecraft and, as a matter of fact, the launch vehicle since about 1962, which was about the same time we started the Gemini program. Now, it was a much more complex vehicle to design and much more complex to build, primarily because of the length of time we were going to fly the vehicle in space and the time we were going to be away from the Earth and, of course, the lunar landing module itself. The Gemini vehicle was an extension of the Mercury technology. Now, in terms of our capabilities and where we stand in the Apollo program, I think, excluding the accident, I think we've come along very well. Certainly the accident was a tragic affair which set us back a great deal, but I think if you took that slice of about a year and a half out of the program, I think that the Apollo program is probably about where most of us expected it to be, and relative to Gemini, I think we're, if anything, a little better off than we were in the Gemini program.
The accident to which you refer was that on the launch pad in January of 1967 in which three astronauts were
yes.
killed. Mr. DeLong?
Chris, we're just a few weeks away from the second unmanned flight of the Saturn V. Even though this is unmanned, I understand it's extremely significant. Could you tell us a little bit about why it is significant?
Well, it's primarily significant from the standpoint of the launch vehicle. We had set a goal back in the original Apollo program that we wanted to fly two Saturn V's before we manned that vehicle. As far as the spacecraft is concerned, I believe that we have already qualified the spacecraft for both flight around the Earth, that is, Earth orbital flight, as well as re-entries at lunar velocities. If we were not to even recover the spacecraft, I don't think it would be too fatal to the program, and I'm fairly certain we would press on. I don't have any notion that that will happen, but I want to point out that the major objective of the next Saturn V flight is to proof the Saturn V vehicle.
In other words, if it passes its test this next time, the flight after that, the third flight, might be with men?
That is our intent at this time, and hopefully that will be the case.
Mr. Maloney.
If we are able to fly men on the third Saturn V and a second test of the lunar excursion module is not necessary, how much time would this save us in the Apollo flight schedule, Mr. Kraft?
Well, I can't answer that question directly without some qualification. If we had to fly, for instance, another LEM vehicle and another Saturn V before we were able to man the Saturn V, I would suspect it would cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 6 months. However, once you make that kind of decision, you then have got to plan your program on the basis of some backup to those particular missions. So it isn't as simple as it might sound. If we were to decide, for instance, that we were not satisfied with the performance of the LEM vehicle based on data analysis, which, by the way, has not been the case to date, we're pretty happy with the LEM-1 results. But if, for instance, we were to decide that LEM-2 had to be flown, we'd also have to put ourselves in the position of a backup flight for LEM-2. You'd have to prepare for some malfunction that may cause us to fly LEM-3 unmanned. So it isn't a simple answer. Assuming that LEM-2 were completely successful and 503 were completely successful, once having decided to do that, then we could go, I'd say, in about 4 to 6 months with man on Saturn V.
I think something I'd like to ask you to elaborate a bit more on, Mr. Kraft, is you're referring to several development programs, all of which must knit together. By LEM, you mean the lunar module. By the 500 series, we're talking about the Saturn V rocket. And then there's the Apollo Command and Service Module itself. There are three major systems there.
Indeed, there are. And you must include the ground performance of the systems that we have on the ground for tracking the vehicle also. So we're really bringing four things along simultaneously, and it requires not only the perfection in flight, but the perfection of preparations at Cape Kennedy.
Mr. Hill?
I'd like to pursue the tracking that you mentioned a little bit. Could you tell us what kind of problems Apollo poses in terms of tracking and what you've done to solve those problems?
Well, the major difference of the tracking system that we have in Apollo is that we've gone to what we call a unified S-band system. This means that we are transmitting ranging information for determining the position of the vehicle, telemetry information for determining the performance of the spacecraft systems, and voice, all at roughly the same frequency. It's a unified system. We've not done this before. It's not too much a change in the state of the art, but it does require some development. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we've already proved that the unified S-band system functions fairly well if we can improve our procedural use of the system in Earth orbit. However, once you leave the Earth and are in translunar flight and at lunar distances, then certainly we have not had a great deal of experience under those circumstances, and the time lags associated with voice, which is a simple thing, will have to be practiced. But the ability to track and receive signals from those distances, and in particular, when you're descending and ascending from the moon, the capability of the ground to determine the space vehicle's position at that time is a very delicate one, and one which will require a great deal of preparation on our part, particularly not having been able to do that before we actually attempt the first landing.
You have a whole new worldwide network for Apollo, too, don't you?
Where well, I wouldn't countries? Say it was new. I'd say that we had augmented the facilities we had at most of the Gemini sites. The new part are the deep space tracking stations, which are located in Canberra, Australia, Madrid, in Spain, and at Goldstone, California, those three deep space tracking systems. But again, we've had a great deal of experience in the unmanned flights, been tracking both Surveyor and Lunar Orbiter, which have been very beneficial in our gaining some experience with that kind of situation.
Mr. DeLong.
Right now we're in an unmanned portion of Apollo. No Apollo astronauts have flown. Could you outline for us, Chris, the types of flights, step by step, that are coming in the next months and years on what's been called the Apollo staircase to the moon?
Yes, of course. Well, the first manned flight will be a flight of the command and service modules with three men on an uprated Saturn 1B. In other words, it's not the Saturn launch vehicle which will carry us to the moon. That will put us in Earth orbit. It will have the capability of checking out the command module, in particular its engines, and getting the spacecraft crews familiar with the spacecraft systems. It's really a checkout of the command and service module. The second flight we have planned is presently planned on the Saturn V. Because of the success we have had with the Saturn V, we would have the capability of reverting to a dual launch, much in a similar nature as the two launches we had in Gemini. However, our prime plan right now is to go to the Saturn V with the second manned vehicle. And it will carry not only the command and service module, but the lunar module, which would be, of course, the module that lands on the lunar surface. Its prime objective will be to really check out the lunar module. It will also give us the first capability to perform rendezvous exercises with the lunar module, similar to the type of exercises we will be doing around the moon once we ascend from the moon and have to rendezvous with the command module in orbit around the moon. The third manned flight is presently planned as a sort of a lunar rehearsal, in that we are going to try again to simulate some of the timelines associated with a lunar flight. We will go to a relatively high altitude, high relative to what we've done in the past, altitudes up about 4,000 miles for several revolutions in order to perfect some of our navigation techniques for looking at stars as well as landmark sightings, to be able to navigate and put that information into the onboard computer. We will do some further lunar module rendezvous with the command and service module to simulate some of the abort conditions of rendezvous at the moons. For instance, if we were to have to abort the descent to the moon, we would go through a similar exercise in rendezvousing with the command and service module. We will also, in that flight, carry out what we call a command module rescue of the lunar module, in that the command module will go through the maneuvers necessary to pick up the lunar module should it run into some problems around the moon. We will simulate that exercise. Following that mission, we will then make some judgment as to what we are going to do next. We really have the program laid out so that we can go either in the direction of a lunar orbit flight or a lunar landing flight. And we will make the decision probably sometime within the neighborhood of about 6 months before that flight is to take place, on whether we will go into lunar orbit and do some exercises around the moon, or in fact attempt a lunar landing mission on that particular mission.
Mr. Maloney?
What would be the reason for a lunar orbit or a circumlunar flight?
Well, I think that there are a large number of things that could bring that about. If you ask me today, I would give you a certain class of answer. If you ask me after we have had, say, three manned flights with the hardware that we are going to utilize to go to the moon, I would probably give you another answer. So if you will, I'll give you today's answer. And that is that we have had little experience with the lunar orbit environment, or the deep space environment, if you will. We do not know in detail the thermal problems that may result when you begin to go away from the vicinity of the Earth in the thermal characteristics of the vehicles we're going to utilize. We will not know too much about the margins of power, the margins of breathing oxygen, for instance, the delta V, or the propulsion and fuel margins that we have to go to and from the moon. We will not have had experience of tracking in vicinity of the moon and determining lunar orbit with the actual antenna characteristics that we have on the spacecraft and our capability to determine orbits accurately in order to perform, say, assists from the manned spaceflight network in rendezvous. The crews themselves will have had little experience with the lighting conditions that are in the vicinity of the moon. Those things today loom as problems which may cause us to be somewhat conservative in our first approach to the moon, so that we have answers to those problems before we are then ready to commit to the other parts of the operation which require descent activity on the lunar surface and ascent from the moon. Now, if you ask me that question a year from now, those problems may in fact not loom so large. There may be other problems with the lunar module itself, which would, for instance, give us confidence to go to the moon and do rendezvous exercises, but not confidence to land because of some problem we may have had with some spacecraft system. So I think that what we're trying to do is plan ourselves a position from the standpoint of mission planning that we'll be able to go in either direction when the time comes.
We'll have more questions for Chris Kraft in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA from the Voice of America. Today we're broadcasting from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, the center of American manned space activities. Our guest is Mr. Christopher Kraft, the Director of Flight Operations for U.S. Manned Space Missions. Our correspondents interviewing him are Arthur Hill of the Houston Chronicle, Ed DeLong of United Press International, and Jim Maloney of the Houston Post. For our next question, let's turn to you again, Mr. Hill.
Well, Chris, going back to the possibility of a circumlunar flight for Apollo, when would you have to decide whether you would include such a mission? What's the minimum time required?
Well, I think there comes a time probably in the neighborhood of about 6 months before you're going to utilize the hardware where you'd have to make such a decision. The decision is not so hard to make, and by the way, it's a lunar orbit flight rather than a circumlunar flight. The decision is not so hard to make that decision. The decision would be much harder to make the decision after the third manned flight to go lunar landing. And then I think that it would be a much more difficult decision to make. For instance, what I'm saying is if we go from a third manned flight to a lunar orbit flight to a lunar landing flight, then the decision is not so difficult to make as compared to the other way around.
I see.
Mr. DeLong?
Chris, where do we stand in our recovery from the effects of the Apollo fire a year ago this past January? Have we just about gotten over the effects of the delay that caused?
Well, I think I'd have to be honest and say that until we have flown the first manned flight in a command and service module, we will not have recouped ourselves from the time loss that was involved. However, I think you must remember that we've, besides working on the fireproofing of the spacecraft, we've also made a large number of modifications to the spacecraft, which in my opinion will allow us to proceed in a much more rapid fashion had we not had that time. So I think that once we begin to fly, we may then be able to make up some of the time we've lost. So until we fly, we have that much time lost, but then we may be able to accelerate at a much more rapid pace because we have been able to make those changes.
Has that delay in any way seriously damaged the chances of landing on the moon by the end of 1969?
No question about it.
Mr. Maloney?
Talking about accelerating the Apollo program for a moon landing, Mr. Kraft, do you feel that it's important for this country to land men on the moon as rapidly as possible, as rapidly as it's safely possible to land that? And if so, why?
Well, I do. I believe that it is that we should do it. I think we've made a commitment to the nation and, frankly, to the world that we are going to attempt that. I think as long as we have the opportunity to do it, we should press on with all orderly haste. I think the key word is the way you put it. We want to do it in a safe fashion, and you can be assured that we will not attempt it until we are satisfied that the risks are a minimum.
I have heard other officials in the space program comment upon another aspect of this time schedule. Mr. Kraft, I wonder if you would address yourself to this too, and that is the just the technological management capability which is demonstrated by such a monumental endeavor. The fact that we say we are going to land on the moon by the end of 1969, for instance, this was said back in the early 60s, and now there is that challenge to our technical management to do this. Would you address yourself to this idea?
Well, that's a rather difficult question for me, an operations man, to talk about. I think we have that still have the capability and still have the time left to have a chance at landing before the end of 1969. In terms of the management, there's no question but what this endeavor has really tested the capability to the utmost of the country to manage such a large, far-reaching program, and as many vehicles, as many different industries, as many different people or walks of life who are involved in this situation. Certainly, I think that the technology that we have gained from the Apollo program in just that sense has been worth the total amount of money that's been spent on the Apollo program. In fact, it's my personal opinion that that is where the gain is. It's true that a great deal of science is gained from and will be gained from the Apollo program, and that cannot be overlooked. But I think the biggest gain to the country and the real reason for this space program in this country is the technological base it furnishes to the total industry.
Mr. Hill.
Well, I wonder if following the Apollo program through to its natural conclusion, a landing on the moon, and looking beyond that, if you philosophically or how you just might feel about having another future goal, say a man landing on Mars or something like that.
I guess we in the business consider ourselves as explorers, in a little different sense probably than Columbus or Magellan, but nevertheless, I think we as a team consider ourselves as a group of explorers, and certainly...
You have a namesake to live up to.
Yes, indeed I do. But I think that we all in the business want to go as far as man can go, and that includes going to Mars, and it includes leaving this universe. And I think that we all look forward to that time. I think it's coming. I think we have an obligation to the United States and an obligation to the world to conduct those kinds of expeditions, and I'm sure we will, given the time and money and when the United States decides that it's prepared to do so.
That reminds me of something, Chris. Let me ask you this. I didn't mention to our listeners that your middle name was what the middle C stood for, Christopher Columbus Kraft. How did your parents happen to name you that, incidentally?
Well, I'm a junior. As my father's handover and left over to me, he was just named that by a good German woman who thought it was a good name.
Okay. Mr. DeLong?
You've made several references to the numbers of people involved in Apollo and to the amount of money involved. About all that the world hears when they're listening to an Apollo spaceflight taking place, or will hear, will be three astronauts and a few men in the Mission Control Center, which you direct. How many people are involved in this program worldwide, and about how much money is involved in it?
Well, at one time, the industry in this country was had about 460,000 people involved in the Apollo program. I think it's down to something like 300,000 now. I'd say when you bring in all the people in the world that have had a contribution to make, it's probably something like a 500,000 people. The money that's been spent on the total Apollo program, which includes the launch vehicles and the complexes that have been built to test these vehicles and to launch them, and the networks required to support them when they're flying, the program has been estimated to be about $20 billion over the period of the program since 1962, and I still think that's probably a pretty good figure.
Mr. Maloney?
After Apollo, we're going into a program called Apollo Applications. Could you describe that briefly to us, Chris?
Well, I don't think that there are many people within NASA right now that could give you a very good description of Apollo Applications. We are in the throes of, within the agency, of trying to come up with what we think the follow-on Apollo program should be.
You mean after what? After the moon landing?
After the lunar landing. And certainly it will involve additional lunar landings to different sites for scientific purposes, more sites that the scientists would be more interested in, and different areas of the moon. And some Earth orbital programs involving proving man's capability for long-duration flight as well as some Earth Resources work. That's a general statement of what we're up to, but I think it primarily depends on the amount of funds which the Congress appropriates in the next few years as to when we will do those programs.
Do you believe that after the lunar landing that our principal goals will be strictly scientific and that we will have accomplished the technology, at least, for space exploration? Will we be over the top of the hill in the technology?
No, I certainly do not. I think that we've only begun to scratch the surface, and I think that the whole future of this country depends on its technological capability, and there's got to be some impetus in order to drive that on, and I hope it's the space business, because I think it is a peaceful endeavor, one which brings people together rather than driving them apart. I think it's a good way to apply support to the technological requirements of the nation.
Mr. Hill.
Well, in that regard, do you think that there'll be more scientific people coming into the program and reorientation along those lines, perhaps changing some of the ways the people have been distributed in the space program before?
Well, there's no question, but I think that we will involve more scientific endeavor in the space program. However, you still require the development type of work necessary to get these vehicles into space, and I think that element of the space program will remain, and as far as the technology of the country is concerned, that's what is important.
I believe we have time for one more question to Mr. Kraft. Mr. DeLong or Mr. Maloney?
You spoke, Chris, of scientific endeavor. Aside from the tremendous engineering feat of just landing on another body in our solar system and taking off and getting back safely, does Apollo itself have any scientific goals in that moon landing?
Oh, certainly. I think that the people who are interested in how the world was formed, the whole geology of the Earth can be found possibly on what we see at the moon, since it's gone through a very different environment than the Earth did. And if the scientists can get enough samples, enough looks at different areas on the moon, I don't think there's any question but it's going to unlock a whole new world of knowledge to these scientists.
Gentlemen, I see our time is up. Thank you for being with us. Thank you very much, Mr. Christopher Kraft.
You have been listening to Press Conference USA, broadcast each week by the Voice of America. Our program today originated at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. Our guest was Christopher Kraft, Director of Operations at the center. The news correspondents were Arthur Hill of the Houston Chronicle, Edward DeLong of United Press International, and James Maloney of the Houston Post. Your moderator was Rhett Turner, VOA science correspondent. Join us again next week at this time for another unrehearsed discussion on Press Conference USA.